ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just 40 years ago, racism was legal in South Africa.
You were a non-person. You were non-white.
I'm Sisonke Msimang. My dad was a freedom fighter against apartheid, and I grew up as part of a global movement to end that injustice. But I don't know much about what Australians did. So join me as I meet the Aussies who took a stand and helped change world history. ABC Rewind Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Could the United States be winning the battle but losing the war?
President Trump is sounding ever more extreme.
He's threatening to obliterate Iran's energy grid if a deal isn't reached.
But the regime is surviving and has global fuel stocks in a chokehold.
There's lots still to come. I'm Geraldine Doogue.
And I'm Latika Berg. This is Global Roaming.
Yes, it's certainly been a week to watch, Latika. I did hear the former Defence Secretary and really long-time soldier General Mattis do an interview publicly where he did say we're in a very tough situation. There's been no strategy that I can see. There's all sorts of events, all sorts of tactics, but there's no strategy, sort of rational strategy that I can see having been outlined. And I thought that was a pretty serious sort of intervention by Mattis.
And preparation. I think that's what is really coming home to roost. How has Iran been allowed to solidify its position, terrorize the Gulf states with very low-cost sort of warfare? I mean, there's even evidence now that they're throwing fireworks up in the sky just to get Gulf states to respond with much more expensive countermeasures and thereby deplete their stocks. I mean, the ingenuity of this is something that is a sight to behold. But here we are. I mean, look at what's happened in Australia this week, Geraldine. The government already back under the pressure, petrol prices going up ahead of Easter. It has so many facets to go, so many tentacles reaching across the world. We don't know how this ends. I do think, and I've suspected this for a long time, there's a bit of a willing to want Trump to fail on Iran.
Yep.
Because there's so many people who just can't stand Trump and they look at all the chaos, they look at all the crazy Truth Social tweets, they look at the lack of strategy and preparation and say, aha, now we're, you know, and it almost leads people to we're on Iran's side, which I do find, frankly, quite bizarre.
Yes. I don't know whether people have really kept an open mind about it. That's what I'm sort of watching for. I'm waiting to see what the arrival of more troops does bring and just the impact of all of that instability around the world in terms of petrol supply. I think myself will also have its yield because it does change the sort of profit and loss, I suppose, the balance sheet of a whole lot of different nations.
Yes, the domestic pressures, I think, will also become very acute now, and you'll see more and more leaders start to say out loud, hey, President Trump, mind finishing the job now?
Yeah.
I think that's a dynamic to watch on the world stage.
So I suppose the question we're really pursuing, is there a roadmap out of this war, with our guest, Dr. Neil Quilliam. He's a specialist in energy policy and geopolitics and foreign affairs at Chatham House in London. And he knows the Middle East well and North Africa. He's also been a senior energy advisor to the UK's Foreign Office. Here he is now. Neil Quilliam, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you very much for having me.
Strategically, how would you describe the conflict right now? How do you understand where we are?
So we're locked in this conflict where the US and Israel are been continuously sort of bombing and attacking Iran for the past 20 days plus, and Iran has found a way to dig in to respond probably much harder and for a much longer period than either side thought by striking out against the Gulf states, compromising their ability to produce oil and gas, but more importantly, seizing control or effective control of the Strait of Hormuz. And it's using this to great extent. This is its key leverage in this battle. And as in a sort of asymmetric warfare, Iran has managed to find a huge lever that it can pull, which is frustrating the Americans and basically sort of bringing Donald Trump to the table where he really wants to negotiate. He's finding himself in a very different position to where he imagined within the first week or 10 days of the conflict.
Would you just, we'll get into detail, I can see that, but the arrival of the Houthis into it as well, what difference, how strong are they? I don't think it's clear cut. And what difference does that make?
They took a very strong beating, actually, in 2024. They started responding to the war in Gaza. And they carried out a series of strikes in Israel or against Israel. The US carried out a very punitive series of strikes and forced them essentially into making a ceasefire, agreeing a ceasefire. And so they've effectively sat out of this theater and until the weekend. They have been replenishing their stocks. They have been fighting a conflict for the last 10, 11 years. And prior to that, they'd engaged in six separate wars with the Saudis. So they are very strong, very robust, very determined. So I don't think we can underestimate the Houthis and where they are at this particular conjuncture. We've seen them send a few missiles, cruise missiles, in fact, into Israel over the last 48 hours. They have been intercepted. The moment they start to send those missiles into the Red Sea towards Bab al-Mandab, which is the other choke point, which stops the Indian Ocean from coming up through the Red Sea and into the Mediterranean, that will stop vessels, that will stop ships from having that easy pathway up through into the Med. And the other dimension to this as well is the Saudis have been diverting some of their oil exports away from the Strait of Hormuz, from the west of the country to the east of the country, and they've begun to export out of Yanbu, which is on the Red Sea. The Iranians have already hit Yanbu, the refinery there. If the Houthis start striking there, then there is no passageway to exit and export crude through Hormuz or through Bab al-Mandab, and that means that oil that's destined either for Europe or destined for Asia is going to be stopped. So they can really amplify the Iranian position in this conflict.
So are you saying, Neil, that the claims about Iran's proxies being weakened or diminished or even defeated or defanged was wildly exaggerated?
I don't think they were defanged. They were certainly taken apart. And I think there was an element of shock in the way in which, not necessarily the way in which Israel has sort of pushed back Hamas, but I mean, Hamas is still there. It's not decommissioning. It's not disarming. I think the bigger shock was really its strike against Hezbollah and how it managed to decapitate Hezbollah within a relatively short period of time. And Hezbollah had sat on the Israeli border with 100, 140,000 rockets that could effectively, missiles that could hit nearly any part of Israel. So the fact that it took it out with its technology was almost quite shocking. And you did see a serious degrading of Hezbollah, most definitely. And we also, we saw a downgrading of the Houthis. But these groups don't go away. I mean, they arm, they rebuild themselves. They have a reason for being, and that hasn't gone away. So they've each has used that period, that interregnum, to reconstitute themselves and to recruit. So they are, all of those groups are weaker than they would have been, 3 or 4 years ago, but they still have the capacity. And I think the Houthis in particular, over the past couple of years, have learned to develop their own missile capabilities.
If they did start to seriously gear up, the Saudis might be inclined to come in much harder, might they not, into these hostilities? The decisions facing the Gulf states are just quite extraordinary at the moment, it seems to me.
They are quite extraordinary. And I think all of the Gulf states are doing their utmost to resist engaging militarily in this conflict, or at least engaging with Iran. But if the Houthis do come into this and they do start targeting shipping that has an impact and can compromise Saudi Arabia's ability to export through Yanbu, then I do think that we'll sort of see, you know, kinetic action from Saudi Arabia in Yemen. However, you know, I alluded to the six wars. They were short wars that Saudi Arabia has fought with the Houthis in the past. And then we've seen effectively, you know, a 10-year conflict in Yemen since 2015. The ceasefire has now been on hold for a good 18 months. The Saudis initially in 2015 thought they could go in and defeat the Houthis. And I remember MBS sort of believing he could do that within a matter of weeks, but got dragged into this conflict. So there will be a large degree of hesitation because they don't want to be dragged into it, but they will want to demonstrate that they have this capability, and they will want to punish the Houthis by, you know, by hitting some of their sort of, you know, arms depots, by trying to strike some of their missile launchers. But they would do so in very close coordination with the Americans.
Neil, it's extremely hard to keep up with Trump's messaging on this conflict, even for Trump. One day he's threatening to strike power plants, next day it's a 10-day reprieve, then he says negotiations are underway, which Iran denies, that he wants a deal, that this war will run for 6 weeks, and he's given himself, it seems, a bit of a hard limit. Do you see any strategy in any of this? And who do you think at this point in time has the leverage?
I've been looking for strategy. I guess we've all been looking for strategy since day one. And I have to say, I do not see a clear strategy. I think perhaps right at the outset of this conflict, Donald Trump probably thought, you know, they could go in, decapitate the leadership, maybe do that sort of Venezuela deal, you know, work with the next layer or next tier of leadership, and then claim victory by saying, well, we've now downgraded again, obliterated, you know, the nuclear program, we've downgraded their ballistic missiles program, and we've quashed, you know, we've quashed the proxies, and now we can reach a deal. But I think where the conflict is now, I think it's past a point of no return. It's I think Trump thought he could probably control this and control the narrative, but I think it's spilled way beyond that now. It's become far more complicated, and as I said earlier, I think, you know, the Iranians have realized that they can use Hormuz as this big point of leverage, not just for the US, but I mean for the world and for the global economy. So,
but they always knew that, right? The Iranians.
They did, but I'm not sure that they ever thought they would actually use it. You know, they knew they had that potential to do so. And, you know, there's always been this sort of underlying logic with Hormuz that the Iranians would threaten to close it, and they've done that on so many other occasions. But they would not actually close it itself, because that would prevent them from exporting their crude. You know, they've been sanctioned for the past 20 years, but they were still exporting around 1.3, 1.4 million barrels a day. So the logic was they would be cutting their nose to spite their face.
And doesn't that likely mean, though, that there will be a response? I mean, again, these could be short-term victories, could they not? If the Americans, if the special forces try effectively aim for Kargil, and I don't know what they're aiming for, but if they aim for Kargil, and where most of the Iranian fuel installations are, and they occupy it as a bargaining chip, isn't that at least a possibility?
It's certainly a possibility, but and Karg Island, I mean, is a, you know, an export terminal through which Iran exports 90% of its oil. So it would immediately sort of cut off Iran's ability to, you know, to export 90% of its oil. So it would have an immediate economic impact on the country. But, you know, this country has sort of lived in opposition effectively for 47 years. It's been under sanction for at least 20 years. Its economy has been compromised by those sanctions, but the regime and Iranians are very creative folks. You know, they've managed to still export crude one way or another. They've still managed to develop a quite a robust economy. So they will manage that one way or another. It doesn't matter how hard it will hurt them. But the other point is, you know, this regime is very much in survival mode.
Neil, is there any way that Trump can pull this off?
I don't think so. I think we've passed the point of no return. I mean, he could pull off a major negotiation, but you know, both sides are so far apart. It's hard to see that coming into being. So for the Iranians to agree to open Hormuz, you know, their demands are obviously extreme. They want no future US bases in the region. I mean, you know, that's not going to happen. They want ironclad guarantees that neither the US nor Israel will strike them and attack them again. This is a bridge too far. They may be able to find small steps. There may be a sort of a short-term ceasefire. But even with that, you know, even if Trump, and I keep saying this, you know, were to declare tomorrow, you know, victory as it stands, you know, we've destroyed this and this, we're now gonna sort of, you know, go home, Iran, open up that strait. I mean, the Iranians are not just going to simply open up the strait again. They know this is their biggest lever. This is the one piece that they can bring the world economy or the global economy to almost to a grinding halt. So they're not going to cede that without ironclad guarantees.
You paint them as if they are in a super strong position at home as well. Like, you think that they're stronger than ever, do you, the IRGC? Again, that doesn't quite ring true to me. I appreciate the appearances are of, you know, they've got extraordinary leverage right now. But the idea that they are in a sort of even more stable position, I find that a bit hard to take. And I certainly don't think the Gulf countries around would accept that.
I think there are two different issues here. I think the IRGC at this current moment are domestically in a strong position simply because, you know, we know
they're prepared to shoot everybody if they have to.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, that, you know, that's it. We've seen them do that, and I've seen very few signs since the 28th of February that, you know, protesters are coming. I mean, who would go out and protest at this particular moment? I mean, it's not the moment to go and seize, you know, to try to seize the ground or to, I mean, these are not the conditions in which regime change can be, fermented, because the regime is probably at its most brutal ever. And, you know, that's saying something. So the threat that it poses domestically is deep and profound. But in discussions with colleagues, you know, we're always looking for parallels. And I think one parallel we could draw is this could be sort of like Iraq, sort of post 1990, 1991. The Iraqi armed forces had been severely weakened. Saddam had been severely weakened, but was effectively left in control. Areas of the country at the time, particularly, there were no-fly zones were sort of imposed in the north, in the Kurdish areas, to protect the Kurds, equally in the south. So you've got almost like a wounded beast. So I think that's probably how I would characterize the IRGC the longer term. You know, they've taken, you know, a massive hit. This has been a very punishing series of strikes from the Israelis and from the Americans, and they're systematically taking out the IRGC's longer term or midterm capability. So there's very well the case that, you know, they could be in this position for the next 10, 15 years. But was it Israel rampant on the side? You know, it could easily go in and continue to, you know, carry out operations against the country. So tough now, but this has been a severe setback.
So if we follow that chart, Neil, that you paint, What does that mean for how the Gulf states adapt to that new future? What is the Gulf states' new or altered relationship with the United States post-Trump? And what do they do about Iran long-term?
Probably behind closed doors, they would now say, you know, the relationship with the US has become a liability because, you know, it's really reset the security, the threat environment in the region. But in the short term, there's no alternative. There is no other security guarantor or protector that then can come in and support them. Equally, you know, they are going to need to rearm very, very quickly after this. They are going to look to investing less money in very big, glamorous projects like NEOM or the Line, and pouring their money into defense. So first off, I think they will probably draw closer to the US, try to deepen their defense relationship, but with a view to looking at the medium term and diversifying their defense relationships, deepening their partnerships, probably with Pakistan, with Turkey, with Egypt, and quite possibly China. I mean, China's nowhere in this, of course, but this is not a sort of one shot, you know, fits all. I think they'll be looking to sort of map out those relationships. Over the past 5 to 10 years, the UAE in particular has been looking to develop its own defense industry. They're still quite young in that space, but I think they'll be investing in that. And one area I'm looking at with colleagues at Chatham House at the moment, the Gulf states themselves coming together and actually working together and trying to come up with some kind of defensive construct. I mean, it's been called in the past...
Like an alliance? Like a NATO, are you talking?
Or? Yeah, I mean, it's often been called in the past like Arab-NATO, a sort of Arab-NATO alliance. I mean, those six states, but it's never... The US has actually pushed them towards that, been pushing it for like the past 15 years. But there's such high levels of mistrust, different ideologies amongst the six of them that they've never managed to get to a position. But given this, you know, this new threat environment, they may well begin to work together a lot more closely.
In fact, I heard, because you are an energy specialist, Neil, I heard Larry Fink, the head of BlackRock, you know, which invests $3 trillion worth of people's money, an amazing comment he made to the BBC last week. He said, look, oil in 4 weeks' time, it could be $42 a barrel or it could be over $200 a barrel. I don't know. And he's in charge of managing people's money. Like the uncertainty is quite extraordinary. You know, we haven't talked about that really, how that factors into the various tactics and strategies that various countries apply. How do you think it will unfold?
I don't know that I can outplay, you know, Larry Fink on this, given where he is. But to be honest, the shortfall of oil and gas has not really been felt yet. There's been enough storage. There has been enough supplies. So what we're seeing with the oil price is really sort of, you know, a sentimental response. But the way I look at this is that somewhere in the distance, we have this sort of slightly growing tsunami coming towards us. And at the moment, we can feel the choppy waters around our ankles. And the reason is because the supply is not going to come when we really need it. When the storage begins to, you know, run dry, it's not going to come. The Gulf Arab state, even if the strait were open tomorrow, we've seen energy infrastructure right across the Gulf targeted and hit. So it's going to take a good probably 6 to 9 months before the oil producing states can recover their position and be producing at the same level. So in the interim, the pain, the shortage of supply is going to hit us. So it's coming towards us. That's the way I kind of characterize it. So that, you know, that $200 figure might be pushing it right at the far end, but that's the direction of travel.
Neil Quilliam, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Geraldine, that was a very grim outlook, I think. I do think what Neil was saying there about the shift in the region, the shift away from the Americans from the Gulf states that you'll see quietly take place, I do think those fault lines are there. And don't disregard what the Iranians now know they have, which is the ability to lob a very cheap drone at any sort of critical infrastructure that's usually a soft target, cause chaos, havoc, and continue to terrorize the region. I do think that's a weapon they hadn't used before that Trump has shown them now they can.
Well, look, I personally have been thinking for a little while, and you think of the end of wars generally, and you think one way and the other, you've got to bring people whom you may describe as appalling into the tent. There's got to be a situation of moving on, you know, that was really what happened post-World War II. It took, you know, Germany had to be brought into the tent in a quite remarkable way, similarly with Japan. And I suppose I think that's what we're now wondering that...
But that was after crushing defeat.
Indeed it was. I accept it was.
And we still need a crushing defeat of Iran. And I don't think even for your optimism, that's what we're looking at.
No, but if it's not a crushing defeat, they are in the tent. My point is, one way and the other, Iran is going to have to be in there because the Gulf countries are going to have to deal with them. I think I agree with you. I think looking at the Gulf countries is what is totally fascinating here.
Last week I was chatting to somebody, ex-Pentagon NATO, who was telling me they helped organise the coalition that went into Afghanistan. And he said the Taliban once told them, you have the watches, but we have the time. And I do think that that's a distinction that shouldn't be forgotten as we look at what the next week or two, and Trump has set himself that deadline of 6 weeks. Iran's not setting itself a deadline of 6 weeks,
no,
is it?
No, it won't. Of course it's not. Now, look, I just must make time for a lovely little bit of feedback. Chris writes in about our Iran coverage, asking for more on Iran's culture, quotes, its celebration of its poets, its architecture, its paradise gardens, its history, films, etc. I know you know more about it than I gleaned from a short trip in 2018. It would help humanise the place and provide a contrast to the miserable regime. Now, look, we can do that, Chris, and focus more on culture and community inside Iran. So do keep listening. It's a terrific suggestion. And lots of positive feedback to Hamish and me after our conversation with David Kilcullen.
I loved this one, Geraldine. I loved this episode.
I did enjoy it, I must say.
It was right up there.
At the American counter, well, he's now Australian-American counterinsurgency specialist. I would recommend catching up on that if you missed it. It's called Is It Time to Ditch Australia's Good Doggy Diplomacy? And Jenny writes, the episode with David Kilcullen on Friday was so refreshing, clear and concise. I profoundly hope our politicians are avidly listening to your show every day. We love hearing from you. It doesn't have to be about conflict in the Middle East, I assure you. What's coming up tomorrow, Latika?
Kylie and I are talking to the Israeli pollster and journalist Dalia Scheidlin to understand better the war from inside Israel. That's a perspective we haven't looked at more recently on global roaming. So
timely.
We'll be talking about, yes, the West Bank too.
Bye-bye, Latika.
See you, Geraldine.
And thanks to our producers, Kylie Gray and executive producer Kylie Morris. Bye-bye.